it's difficult in some ways, it seems, in many of our convert communities to talk in a very traditional way about enlightenment or liberation or realization in Buddhism for a few reasons that maybe I'll unpack as the month goes on. One of them being that I think it's actually quite common even in Buddhist circles, and now by that I really mean convert Buddhist circles, so non-Buddhist communities in America and Europe and kind of the globalized Buddhist world, composed primarily of non-Asian folks or non-heritage Buddhist folks. And I make that distinction because the way that I'm going to talk then about ideas about liberation is almost, I think, exclusive to the West in some ways, which is that in many of my Buddhist communities, both Zen and Theravadan, I've heard lots of folks say in either casual or very serious ways that they don't, in a certain way, believe in full liberation. That it's actually, there's actually quite a bit of very sincere, beautiful Dharma practice going on by folks who hold the idea of, I'll say, like permanent or complete or final, full liberation, full awakening, in a kind of agnostic way, in a kind of like, yeah, maybe, sort of way. And I've wondered a lot about this over the years because it might seem, in a sort of logical way, like that would foreclose a bit of the possibility of practice. Like if, you know, if I said, here's Highway 80, Interstate 80, you get on it, you know, just over there on Ashby Street, and you take it east, and you just keep going, and you know, if you persist, and you have some, you don't have an accident along the way, at some point you cross the George Washington Bridge, and you're in Harlem, and you've arrived in New York City. And so, like, if New York is the destination, and Route 80 is the path, and Ashby is the entrance, why would you put forth all the effort it takes to drive or bike or travel in whatever, all that way, if you didn't in a certain way believe that New York either existed or was worth getting to? Because, you know, to get there you have to do all sorts of difficult things. You have to cross Donner Pass, you have to trek through, you have to make it past Las Vegas, which is a thing unto itself, you have to make it through the desert, up and over the Rocky Mountains, which is fierce, and then across the plains, and it's a long way. And so it might seem obvious that if you want to get somewhere, you have to believe that it exists, and hold and not lose faith in that thing as you travel. But first of all, a whole bunch of Buddhist traditions came along somewhat later than the earlier tradition, and Zen was one of them, that understood this very profound, mysterious thing about New York, liberation, we might say, the destination, which is that it's not really a destination. It's not a thing that's in the future far away that you have to work hard to get to, except that it also is that, but it's also not that. And doctrines appeared that recognized, for instance, that to think that liberation is something that happens in the distant future after you're all purified keeps it in a kind of dualistic framework where it's not actually the absolute. If it's absolute freedom, how could it be absolute freedom if you're not there yet? Absolute freedom has to be everywhere all the time, or else it's not absolute. It's not permanent if it hasn't happened yet. Therefore, they would say, liberation is right where you are. It's right in ordinary mind. It's here all the time. The only thing preventing us from being free or resting into that liberation is that we don't know that it's here. We don't know how to rest into it. That doctrine is incredibly powerful and was incredibly influential and is profoundly confusing. Because if you really go for it in that direction, then what's up with practice, right? If I'm already free right where I am, why would I get on the road to begin with? And the mysterious answer is, you're already free, but you don't know it. And so the only thing you need to do is you need to walk the path in order to know it. But once you know it, or when you know it, you realize that walking the path didn't get you somewhere. It just stripped away the not knowing. Not knowing is a translation of avidya, ignorance, which is the fundamental cause of suffering and is, in a way, the opposite of liberation. Where liberation is knowing, non-liberation or bondage is not knowing. So that doctrine has been incredibly powerful. But part of what it has done in the West is that folks who don't have a lot of discernment around the difference between paths have, in a certain way, heard that teaching, been attracted to it, and it has become, in a way, the central teaching around liberation. It's very different from the early tradition, the Theravada tradition that I mostly teach from here, where liberation is not actually that kind of absolute, abstract, now I'll say tantric or non-dual approach, but is actually in a much more kind of ordinary or resonant with our ordinary experience way, it is actually a goal. It is actually a destination, a location. And so I think that there are a lot of folks who either are unclear about what the traditions, plural, say that liberation is, or in some way, and this is a cultural piece that I'm just going to speculate on, in some way are uncomfortable with a teaching that says that there is, first of all, such a thing as full and final liberation and not just kind of relative improvement along the way, but also that that thing could be something that takes work to get to and you're not there yet. They sort of go together, the idea that it's always already here and that it's not different from your ordinary existence. I wonder if the idea of liberation, of full liberation as something that you're not in yet, to, this is totally just thinking out loud, but I've been thinking about this for a bit, wondering whether that idea is actually kind of frightening or even a little insulting to a certain kind of American pride. Like, how dare you say that I'm not already there in some way? I wonder if that's partly why the Zen or the Advaita teachings did so well in this culture. I set that piece aside. I'm not too concerned about that. But what I want to do then this month is lay out in some detail the structures offered in the Theravada tradition, in the Pali Canon, around liberation and freedom. And ask us, in a way, how do we relate to the idea or the proposal or the teaching that that it's possible to absolutely and completely end stress and suffering in this life? Not just to make it relatively better or to be able to deal with our complicated lives better, but actually in a radical and uncompromised way, fully and completely end the cycle of suffering. Some folks might think it's possible, but also, in addition to there being a whole wing of folks within modern Buddhism that think it doesn't exist or that it's not possible, there's another whole wing that thinks it's undesirable. that actually have gotten the sense that liberation in some ways is a turning away from the world, away from relationship, away from connection, away from engagement. And in that sense, it's actually a kind of self-centered, kind of privileged, deluded idea. And that has several layers. Some folks think of the very idea of liberation as expressed in the early system as profoundly patriarchal or profoundly kind of mental in a certain way, disembodied. I don't think that those characterizations are true at all from reading the texts and talking with senior practitioners, but I understand where they might come from. And there is certainly a strand of deep dispassion, disenchantment, profound letting go and release in these images. So I'm not going to propose that you believe or take on the teachings that I'll bring in. But I want us to be conversant in them. And I think the main question as we look at some of these ideas is, what are we doing this for? Why would you undertake a practice? What is it that you're actually hoping to gain or find or attain or release or let go of as a result of practice? And over again in the teachings, there's the sense that if you don't really know why you're doing it, you're not really going to get anywhere. You know, it's a little bit like if I want to train in a sport or a game or something. Like if I want to play basketball, let's say, I kind of like basketball. Tennis. I like tennis for some strange reason. I think actually it's because years ago, am I going to say this out loud? I thought that Rafael Nadal was really cute. And I was just like, well, he's hot and strong, so tennis is probably awesome. He's this sort of Spaniard, kind of unbeatable guy. Then he totally got beaten. But hot. So I got into tennis for a while. But I don't know much about it. Like, I don't even really know how to count, like, what it goes, like, 0, 15, 30, 40. There's some love in there. Which, like, really, the whole game is kind of mysterious to me. And the details of it, like, exactly what they're doing or how they're doing it, I actually don't know anything about it. And I probably have never watched a full game. But every once in a while, I tune in at, like, you know, at the big games, and I pretend like I know about it. And so there's this way that, like, you know, and I can sort of do a very simple volley over the net with someone who's not very good, like my 3-year-old, you know, I do pretty well with. And that's about it for me in tennis. So then we might say, am I on the path to becoming a virtuoso tennis player, a really good tennis player? And someone who doesn't know tennis at all might be like, oh, yeah, you can hit the ball over the net and you kind of like the game. You're on the path. And we could say that that's true. But someone who actually knows the game, who watched me play or listened to me talk about it, might say, okay, you clearly like the game, but if you want to actually become good at it, you're not using your time very well. You're not practicing accurately or with any precision. What if this is something we might say about Dharma practice, like meditation practice? Like, if you don't know where you're going, or much about technique, or really anything about the subtleties of the path, what are you actually doing sitting there? And there's all sorts of teachings that say, kind of slightly sarcastically, here's a Zen one, that says, if sitting made you enlightened, all the chickens would be liberated. And it's a little insult of, like, what do you think you're doing there, just sitting there? Do you think that's getting you anywhere? And to say that without sarcasm would be something like this. Just sitting without really attending either to technique or to the full path of inquiry or to a sense of where that inquiry is leading is like playing around at the game without even really knowing the rules. Right? You're not actually improving. You're hanging out, and it can be pleasurable, but it's not getting somewhere. That's a little too fierce than I actually want to put out. I want to propose that actually just sitting there as a contrast to our busy lives running around getting into trouble is actually a pretty decent thing to do, and that it's a start. Maybe I'll say that my being kind of attracted to Rafa Nadal and thinking that tennis is cool but knowing nothing about it is actually potentially the beginning toward getting really into the game and learning more about it and becoming, you know, somewhat masterful at it, if that's even possible for a game when people retire at 32 and I'm 47. So it's over for me as a tennis star. But I'm not ready to say that I've just wasted my time being attracted to it. And I'm not ready to say that people just sitting are wasting their time. Absolutely not. And here's one presentation then about where the path goes. So in the Pali Canon, which is the body of texts that's the basis of Theravada Buddhism, liberation or enlightenment or realization, I like the term realization. I don't like enlightenment particularly, mostly because it's a European word that refers to a very different thing. I prefer to reserve the word enlightenment for the European enlightenment, which was kind of rationality and science and all of that in the 15th century around there. But it got lumped into this system by Europeans who were like, oh, that's like our enlightenment, which it's not at all. The technical term in the early texts is the paths and fruits. Path is magga, fruit is phala, P-H-A-L-A. And they're always together, the path and fruit. And it's thought of this way. There's a series of deepening realizations, four levels, beginning with a profound life-changing and probably the most important of the liberations, the first one, which is called stream entry, sotapanna. Entering the stream of the noble ones. And the noble ones, Arya, is the term for those who have attained one of these four. I also don't like the word levels, but we'll call them levels, paths and fruits. And it's a little bit like this. The path is the path is like the approach to and the arrival in a certain realization. And then the fruit is the knowing that realization has happened and is complete. And there's a huge emphasis in the tradition, not just on the experience of a kind of liberation, but on the knowing of it right afterward. So there's a moment or an insight or an understanding, a shift in your being that's profound, and then there's a recognition of it. Oh, that happened. And this is really important because that suggests to us that liberation is not a vague, like, subconscious, I'm slowly maturing over the course of the decades, but you never really know the moment. It actually suggests that we mature slowly and gradually into our practice, but that there are these moments that can be recognized. Oh, something has happened that we can see and that we can know. And then what we're given is the markers of what that thing is. So the four stages, and I'll talk about these all month, so I'll just give you the briefest sort of layout now. The four stages are stream entry, once returner, non-returner, and then arahant or perfected one. And I'll talk about the returners. That's really a reference to, all of them in a way are references to how many rebirths you'll have. But the thing that's most important about stream entry, the tremendously important thing about it is, I think, and I'll emphasize, that it is the marker of non-backsliding. Once you've entered the stream, you are, and this is just the tradition, you are guaranteed to realize full liberation, absolute liberation from suffering, within seven lifetimes at the most, which, in the span of infinite eons, is really quite brief. And so stream entry means you're in. That's why you've entered the stream. In a certain way, once you've entered the stream, you're being carried by the current of the Dharma, the current of truth as it is, and your practice cannot fail to bear fruit at that point. And this is tremendously important. And if we think about it, not so much as a kind of ancient metaphysics, which it is, but if we think about it kind of psychologically or developmentally, think about it developmentally. Like, you've all gone through a process bit by bit of, you know, being children, being older children, being not quite children anymore, being really not children anymore, being adults, at least in age, and the aging body, that's happening. But, you know, you wouldn't be here over and over each week if you hadn't landed in some amount of another kind of maturity. When was the moment when you knew that you were an adult and that you would never again be a child? Do you think you could have noticed that moment? Been like, oh, boom, that it's happened. I think for a lot of us, it happens at a moment of intense experience, you know, like a tragedy or something happens where you have to show up in a different way, nobody else is taking care of it, and boom, you're an adult, and you will never not be an adult. Yeah? So that moment, that's your non-backsliding moment. You're like, oh, I will never again be a child. So stream entry is the moment when you will never again be an unliberated person, a person confused in a certain way by experience. So then these four levels or progressive kind of, it's really a subtractive process, a progressive stripping away of what are called fetters. And just to say, like, the language and imagery of bondage and slavery runs throughout the texts. Right? Non-liberation is said to be like slavery, like bondage, like being in prison. And so the language for what is released when one is liberated is fetters, right? A nice old word. But a fetter, right, was the iron thing around your ankle connected to a ball in the old cartoons. You drag it around, clanking your chains, dragging your fetters. That's non-liberation in this tradition. So at each of the four kind of layers of release, some of these fetters are cut through completely, like just released from your body, or weakened. And so I'm going to start in the beginning with talking about the first ones. Because stream entry affects five of the 10 fetters. It eliminates three and weakens two. So I'll just read you a bit of a text here. This is Majjhima Nikaya 64, called the Maha Malunkya Sutta, or the Greater Discourse to Malunkya Putta, who was a monastic. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. So the Buddha is living at his most favored monastery, given to him by the great lay donor Anathapindika, who bought it for a tremendous sum from Prince Jetta, a wealthy person, and built this beautiful monastery where the Buddha spent a couple dozen years, rains retreats. He spent more time at this monastery than any other. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, and the bhikkhus is the monks and nuns. Bhikkhus, and maybe it was just monks, but we're going to say monks and nuns. And that probably means, in many of those cases at least, there would have been lay people present. He's addressing the bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, venerable sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this, bhikkhus, do you remember the five lower fetters as taught by me? When this was said, the venerable Malunkya Putta replied, venerable sir, I remember the five lower fetters as taught by the Blessed One. But Malunkya Putta, says the Buddha, in what way do you remember the five lower fetters as taught by me? So the Buddha basically shows up for the evening talk. He says, hey, do you guys remember the list? And someone's like, I remember the list. And he goes, in what way do you remember it? So then, Malum Tiapota is really on the spot here. I should remove my glasses. Venerable Sir, I remember personality view as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. I remember doubt. I remember adherence to rules and observances. I remember sensual desire. I remember ill will as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. It is in this way, Venerable Sir, that I remember the five lower fetters as taught by the Blessed One. Okay. So the fetters are, you know, some of them are hindrances, basic hindrances. So two of them are sensual desire and ill will. These are the two that are not eliminated in stream entry, but are substantially weakened. So sensual desire, we use the word sensual to sort of be like a mild word for sexual, but really let's use it in its more broad understanding as a desire for contact with pleasurable sensory experience of any kind. So that's the desire for delicious food, for comfortable clothing, for pleasurable temperature around me, for pleasing sounds, for pleasing visual images, all of the physical sensory stimuli that we crave. So this is sensual desire, a desire for pleasurable sensory experience. And then ill will, or hatred, which we talked about quite a bit a few weeks ago, ill will is this, in a sense, rejection of life and connection by giving in to a kind of hatred of experience or of things or of people, right? Wishing someone to be not well. And so that, again, this is a deep hindrance born of discomfort, born of fear, born of separation. So these two are among the deepest of the hindrances or the great poisons. And they are not eradicated by stream entry, but they're weakened. And we can think somewhat about, like, oh, what does it mean to, like, have an experience that's deep and profound and liberating, but these like, deep karmas, which is really what they are, kind of habits in the heart, are still there. They're not yet uprooted. They're weakened, but not uprooted. But the first three are eliminated by stream entry. So, and we might say it a different way. Stream entry is what happens when these qualities are eliminated. So there's no stream entry outside of the eliminating of these three factors, these fetters. This is what defines liberation. So the first is personality view. The Pali is Sakaya Ditti. And it's often understood really as the belief that my individual personality is who I am. Like my sense of myself. This is really a first, not really a first. You've had insights to this quite a bit along the way as you practice, but in stream entry, piercing or cutting through Sakaya Ditti, personality view, is like think of it kind of like, you know, when you're watching a really compelling movie, and then for some reason, at some point, you get disconnected from what's happening on the screen. Like, you get a sensation actually in your body, or you have to go pee, or something like that, and you turn away from the screen, and there's this kind of breaking moment when the all-enveloping fiction that you've been in, that has been so real and you've been emotionally invested in it, you've been tracking that story, you've been in the story, that bond breaks for a moment and you return to the world where you know that that's fiction. And there's nothing non-fictional about it. It's like you snap the belief in the story. So the breaking of Sakaya Ditti, of personality view, is the moment when you realize that your whole personality, your narrative, the thing that you think of as you, is a certain kind of fiction. It might be a beautiful fiction, a useful fiction, an educational fiction, a profound fiction, as much fiction is. Right? This doesn't denigrate the movie. It actually just puts it in its place. So breaking the fetter of personality view is this moment when you realize, and this is irrevocable, this is said to be, you can never go back from having seen this. When you see that your personality, the thing you call yourself, is actually just a composite, a flickering story based in conditions, it's not you. When awareness unhooks from that by becoming aware of something else, for instance, that is not that, that breaking never fully disappears. Like, you can go back into the movie, of course you do, but you know it's a movie. And it's sort of like you were born in the movie theater with the movie already running, so how could you know it wasn't reality? This is Plato's cave. It's an ancient, ancient metaphor in many traditions, right? The metaphor is you were born in the movie theater, all you see is the movie theater. At some point, someone outside the door goes, yo, and you're like, what? And in Plato, when he says it, he's perceptive about it, because he says, like, yeah, somebody actually, like, gets out of their chains, goes outside, sees the real sunlight, sees that it was just a movie, is like, holy shit, this is way better, goes back in, tells the people, hey, everybody, it's just a movie. And what Plato says quite accurately is, oh, all the people watching the movie, they kill that guy, right? You don't want to hear it, because he or she is really telling you that your entire life has been, or might seem like it's being told that it was a lie. It wasn't a lie, but it seems like that because you're so invested in the movie. When I was 11, between the ages of like kind of 9 or 10 and like 14, I read The Lord of the Rings well over a dozen times. At a certain point, I just flipped around reading my favorite parts. The Mines of Moria was my favorite part. But there was a very distinct feeling that I remember from near the end of the book, where the story has ended and I'm just kind of reading on into the appendices that are talking about the lay of Beren and Luthien and what happened to Aragorn and what was her name? The elf princess who gets left behind because of love, and then she goes to Lothlorien and all the elves have left and she dies on a hilltop and returns to Earth. Like, I was reading every last little bit in the end because I recognized that I didn't want to leave that world. All I wanted was to remain immersed in Middle Earth because, you know, modern Earth wasn't all that great looking in 1984. But that's the feeling. I didn't want to break Sakayaditi. I didn't want to break the immersion in that story. So personality view, doubt, wichikicca, and doubt here really means doubt about the teachings, doubt that the Dharma is true, only breaks with stream entry. That one's almost like, it's like chicken and egg. What it's like, is it that suddenly the teachings were totally clear to you, or that like you had some other experience that was like, whoa, and suddenly the teachings make sense? Like, it's a little, I'm not sure in this case, in the case of this fetter, whether it's a result of stream entry or it's a cause of it. It doesn't matter at all. It's one of the things that breaks. No longer do you have doubt about the Dharma, about the teachings. And then the third one that ends forever is translated here as adherence to rules and rituals. Probably this originally meant thinking that external ritual, like the Vedic fire sacrifice, was going to be able to liberate you. Observing kind of external rituals was going to be enough, or was going to do it. Somehow there would be a kind of magic in observing the rules that would liberate you. And that's also seen through with stream entry. So we'll talk more about the later fetters, but this moment then of non-regression. It's so clear in the text that stream entry is a distinct thing, that practice matures and qualities are worked on. The text talks about the the Sangha, or community of monastics and lay people. And sometimes it describes it like this. Within the community, there are people working towards stream entry, and there are those who have attained stream entry. There are those working toward once return, and those who have attained once return. Those working toward, and those who have attained non-return, and those working toward, and who have attained arhamship. And excluded are people who aren't working toward anything. Like, they're not in the mix. In a sense, right, if you adhere even a little bit, I think, to this model, you might consider yourself as one working toward stream entry or working toward whatever your next path is. And so there's this sense, then, that something unfolds in practice where at a certain point it's ripe in you that your understanding both of yourself, Sakkaya Ditti, the end of personality view, and your understanding of the practice, doubt is released, doubt about the teachings, and what that practice is, like, it's not a ritual practice. That's the thing that resolves. It doesn't mean that you're suddenly happier or that all your stress is gone, right? And sensual desire and ill will are only weakened by this. Like, they're still there. You can have a profound stream entry experience, understand that yourself is empty, understand what the path consists of, and you can still walk out of the room and get yourself into trouble by lusting after the wrong person or, you know, getting mad and blowing your lid. You forgot, basically. But the liberation of stream entry is still irrevocable. Like, you won't ever fully think that the movie is reality ever again. We mostly relate to practice in a psychological way, many of us. And so I think that the breaking of Sakkaya Ditti is, for a lot of folks, kind of the most important. And it is the first one in the list. It is the thing, I think, that this tradition points to as, like, yeah, this is what breaks. It's the first thing to break, is a belief in the solidity, the permanent solidity of the self. And then everything else is a little bit kind of around that, right? When that happens, you know that the Dharma was true, you know that rituals didn't get you there, you know that sense desire and ill will are hindrances. They're not who you really are, and you're not embedded in them anymore. And I think this is why the word Buddho or Buddha, meaning wakeful, becomes sort of the invocation throughout the tradition. Wake up, wake up, wake up. And that it has the same quality of waking up from a dream. Right, when you wake up from the movie, you wake up from a dream, and you just know instantly that you're awake. Or slowly, if you're a slow waker-upper. But you know, oh, I am now awake, I am not dreaming anymore. And that realization, the end of doubt, is the beginning, then, of the whole rest of the path. And everything else that unfolds through there is a deepening and refinement of this first cataclysmic break in the story of your life. And last week, I'll end with, last week I told the story of Shariputra, the one deepest in wisdom, or the week before last, deepest in wisdom, and him going to his mother and giving her a powerful Dharma talk right before they both die. And what he does, he knows he's about to die, and he wants to repay his debt to his parents. And his mother has always resisted the Dharma, even though her son is a huge, like, kind of superhero, you know, amazing teacher in the Dharma, one of the most beloved monastics. He goes back to her and teaches her gradually, in one talk, with all of his skill in teaching, born of decades and decades of practice in teaching. And he does it in such a way to bring her to stream entry. Not past that, but just to stream entry. But then having done that, knowing that she is now established in the Dharma and will be fully liberated within at least 7 lifetimes, he's repaid his debt to her as his mother. And he takes his leave and he goes and dies. So that's his final gift, is the bringing of his mother to stream entry. Maybe the kind of the flavor that I'm curious about in discussing a bit these is a little bit in the direction of the, like, kind of, what do you think? Do you, this is just an ancient story. This could just be another movie. Like, does it make sense to you? Do you hold this maybe I'll just say, like, does it make sense? You know? How does this aspect of the teachings land for you?
Can I?
Yeah, please.
The movie that comes to mind is The Matrix, where
that's the movie.
You know, it's just he didn't want to believe it.
Yeah.
Take the red pill or the blue pill. It's like, you know, it just seems so real.
Yeah.
But that was a eye-opening for me.
Yeah.
The whole concept.
Yeah. Yeah. The Wachowskis were reading their Dharma. That's the model, really, is that, like, it's once you wake up from the Matrix, once you exit the Matrix, you can't ever really go back in. But also, you can go back in knowing your power. In other words, one of the things that happens to Neo once he exits the Matrix and figures out who he is that he can go back in and be unhurt.
Yeah.
Because he knows it's all just a creation of the mind. It's all just image. One of the things that it's said that you wake up to is that your place in the stream of birth and death. So that, like, the harm or the death of this body is radically recontextualized. Because it's not me that's dying. It's like, yeah, this body could be harmed. And maybe that's not useful, and I'm going to protect it, and I want to protect bodies from being harmed. But that's very different from believing that this is me. And that the killing of this body somehow hurts me in some kind of existential, fundamental way. Right? So his gradual liberation starts off with him waking up from it, and then bit by bit is empowering as he figures out that actually he's not subject to even the laws of nature within the Matrix. So then if he wants to fly, he can fly. He gets supernatural powers, which is one of the results of liberation, or it's one of the results of concentration in the early system. But they're intertwined. Once you realize that everything is empty, the whole world behaves differently, or you behave differently in it. So that's the model.
I have to think about this, but I'll throw this out. Things have happened in my life that have always confused me, because and I'm looking for kind of benevolence behind this whole thing. But for instance, when I was in college, my girlfriend and I were walking through Chinatown, and a guy pulled a gun on us, and I realized we'd walked a block off the main street, and there was no one around. It was warehouses, and it was just us and this guy with a gun. And the predominant thing in my mind was, he's showing me, he didn't say anything, he just showed us this gun. I thought, well, he's trying to sell us a gun, and it's probably stolen. Why would I want a stolen gun? So I just looked at him, I said, no thanks, and we just walked away. And so where did that thought come from? And like another time, I was driving down the freeway late at night, and there's this like 18-wheeler coming in our lane straight to us.
Woo.
And we're just like, holy shit. And then somehow at the last minute, he turned off and crashed. And but it's like, I had some really close calls.
Yeah.
That it's like, it's almost like, Yeah, I drove a car off a cliff once in Marin County. It was like a 40-foot drop, Lucas Valley Road. And for some reason, at the last minute before I was going off, I turned it, the wheel, which caused us to roll on our side. So we rolled down sideways. Hmm. Anyway, my brother and I are sitting at the bottom of this dry riverbed, 3 o'clock in the morning, drunk, going, are we still alive? I don't know. We just walked home. So it's like,
dude,
it's like I'm in that movie and someone's going,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So, bizarre.
Bizarre. And, yeah, those are, it seems for a lot of folks that those are the kinds of moments that can either, like, deepen us being embedded or make that kind of break where we kind of snap out of it for a moment, you know. And, you know, who knows? Who knows? And you said, like, you know, I'm looking for a kind of benevolence behind this. I think, isn't that, it's ancient to look for a benevolence behind it, you know. Like, what is all the religions other than some way of us being like, is there a benevolence behind this whole thing? And there is, in lots of different ways that are metaphorical or real or layered in culture. But this teaching on stream entry suggests that it's actually possible to get unbound. That's one of the definitions of nirvana or nibbana. We'll talk about the end of the path.
Unbound
from the story, from the movie, that's in a way that's different from just dying. Like, I could die while I'm watching a movie, and it would end the movie for me, but I wouldn't necessarily realize that it was a movie. It might just be like, oh, I was having this kind of amazing life where this dude, you know, rides a dragon and people pull out their wands and da-da-da-da, we just saw Fantastic Beasts. Where to imagine them, whatever, something. It wasn't as good as the first one. But the idea of liberation actually is that you can exit the movie while you're alive and then just, like, walk out into the night, and it's a different, you're like, ah, that was a sort of stressful universe. People were exploding, wands were coming. It's like, oh, you just walk out and you'd be like, oh, nobody's going to, like, pull a wand on me. I mean, pull something else, but not a wand or the green magic spell coming at the end. And that's liberating. You know. What would it be like to just, like, leave the story of your life just here, you know, as an offering, and then walk out into the night? Mm-hmm. Live the rest of your life. What would you do? Right? Anything else for tonight? I'll keep quiet in this direction.
I'd have to leave my mind here.
Well, that's part of the point. That's why the meditation that we started with was that most of what the mind is doing is it's holding on to the past or the future. In the present, there's not actually that much happening. Mm-hmm. And so then the mind, if you can learn how to hang out without falling off either side, it's actually quite peaceful. It's pretty quiet. Once the worry shuts up. So in a way, we just practice that over and over. It's like you're practicing liberation. You're just practicing not being caught again and again and again and again until at some point you're like, dope! And you just go home. You just walk out of the movie. You're just like, oh. So I'll give you a homework assignment then for some time. You're in a movie theater, you're watching the movie. The simple homework assignment is every once in a while, turn away from the movie and just, like, look at the projector, look at the other people, be like, oh, look where we are. Wow. Was this really worth $15? No, you know, whatever. The deeper practice is to watch a movie, really get into the story, and at some point notice that it's stressful, because movies are stressful. They've got drama, people are getting hurt or heartbroken or whatever. At some point, notice that it's stressful. The story itself is stressful. and leave. Just be like, I don't I like stress. That. Walk out.
No, I play video games, and I'll feel the stress, and yeah. I realize I'm holding my breath.
It's totally stressful.
So I'm using the meditation to focus on my breathing while I'm playing.
Yeah, totally. So the practice is to be like, this is stressful. Just put it down and walk out.
Yeah.
Right. You don't actually care about the end of the story, right? That's delusion. The thing to do is be like, this is not pleasant. Leave. There's the homework. We'll close for tonight. We'll keep looking at this through the month. We'll look at it from some different angles, and probably by the end of the month, we'll work our way toward the vast non-dual peace. Maybe we'll end up somewhere like the Diamond Sutra for the end. That would be a pleasure. But we'll stick with Malunkyaputta and for a little bit here, talk about the fetters, and just continue to peel away this idea that first of all, it's totally possible. Secondly, it's desirable to do so, and that you can do it, and that it's not death or the end or extinction, but is actually something radically different from that. Thanks for your presence and your warmth, as always, showing up on a rainy night. Thank you also for your generosity in donating to sustain the group. It means everything to the group's continuity for you to do that. So thank you so much for all of that, and I'll be here all month. We'll carry on. See you soon.
Thanks. Thank you. So.